Hey guys, Bill here. Before we get started today, just wanted to talk to you about our partners here at the Bill Barnwell Show, the founding sponsor of the show. Some might say, I might say, it's my show, it's my choice. That's SeatGeek. And of course, you know SeatGeek does an incredible job of aggregating tickets from all over the web and using their deal score technology to make sure you get a great deal. What you might not know, what you might have forgotten, is that it's not just for the Super Bowl, although hopefully you enjoy taking $250 off your SeatGeek purchase for a Super Bowl ticket. Ended up seeing a great game there. The good news is you can get tickets to another game that isn't quite as expensive as the Super Bowl. Of course, baseball's coming up. You might want to get tickets to the NBA or NHL, which is in full swing. MLS is coming up. All kinds of things you can go see with SeatGeek. Everything from Major League Baseball to tennis with fighting included, which I'm assuming it's not just random fights on the street, but of course UFC, MMA, boxing, all kinds of fight sports, I would presume and hope. Good news is SeatGeek will sell you tickets to any event you really want, and it will do the best possible job of getting you tickets at a reasonable price. And you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase by using my promo code, which is Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. That's my last name. Use the SeatGeek app. Enter my promo code, Barnwell, and make your first purchase. You'll get $20 back. You can't beat that deal. So go to SeatGeek, get the app, enter promo code Barnwell, get $20 off your first purchase today. Now, enjoy the show. Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. It's Monday, February 5th. 2018, and you know what that means. The football season is over. 2017 has come to an end in the Super Bowl. The Eagles won 41-33. FYI, if you were worried about spoilers, I have some bad news. I just spoiled the Super Bowl for you. I apologize. You probably shouldn't have downloaded this podcast. That's on you. But Eagles win in an upset. Certainly I was not expecting the Eagles to win. Someone who was, though, I brought on the show for many reasons, among this is one, Will Brinson of CBS, who wrote that the Eagles were going to win 28-17, and it was a higher scoring game perhaps than that. But you mentioned, Will, that Philly has weaknesses the Patriots can expose. Looking over the other CBS picks here, Pete Prisco, Jason Lockett Four, Jamie Eisenberg, John Breach, a lot of people said that the Patriots are going to win. So, Will, what did you see in advance that led you to pick the Eagles to win, and then how did they play out when it came to the actual game on Sunday?
Well, Bill, thanks for having me on and for inviting me for the post-Super Bowl show. That's how I know that we truly are good friends, when you would take Monday to chat with me as opposed to the many other venerable people that you could have put on. But I will say this, with respect, I was doing our Pick 6 podcast with Pete and Nick Costas earlier on Monday, and mm-hmm. and Pete was like, "You just picked that score for clicks," and I was like, "No, I didn't." He's like, "Well, you weren't really that right. The Eagles barely won. They weren't even that big of underdogs." It's like, "Well, which one is it, Pete?" Like, I mean, nobody thought the Eagles would win because the Patriots have Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. And I'll be honest, I don't think that game played out exactly the way that I believed it would, in the sense that I was under the impression the Eagles would be able to get pressure on the interior and on the edge mm-hmm. of Tom Brady, and they didn't do that. They didn't get any pressure on Brady until the very end, when Brandon Graham strip sacked him and helped save the game. I think that if you had told me that Tom Brady would throw for 500 passing yards, three touchdowns, the Patriots would never punt, he would be sacked one time, I would not believe you if you told me they would lose. And I would certainly not have picked the Eagles. I would have picked the Patriots to win something like 35-10, if that had been the case, and you had explained that to me beforehand. But instead, it was Nick Foles who rose above everything else and managed to really play an exceptional game. And I think, to me, the biggest standout, and I wrote about this, I was not alone in writing about this. I think Dan Graziano did it for ESPN. Mm-hmm. Greg Rosenthal did it for NFL.com, Peter King did it for, MMQB, the Philly special, the play in which Doug Peterson went for it on the fourth and one from goal really personified exactly. And you might have done it too. I've been walking around Mall of America shopping for discounted Super Bowl gear for my family, so I haven't read your column yet. But I think it really personified what the Eagles did. So my apologies if you also read about it.
No. Of course. I mean, I mentioned it, but I think Dan covered it pretty well in his column, and the columns you mentioned also did a great job. I mean, it was an incredible decision. It was a decision that, in a vacuum, would be insane. And not like it's supported by math. It is a play they had practiced throughout the postseason, according to Lindsey Jones. It is a play that they executed quite comfortably to perfection. It wasn't like it was a tough throw or a tough catch. I mean, it was a breeze. The thing I mentioned in my column is, and of course, you know, if you watch the game, and I'm assuming you watch the Super Bowl, I'm not suggesting that you don't watch the tape, but the Patriots ran a very similar play earlier in that quarter. So the only thing I could think was, imagine if you're Doug Peterson and you've practiced this play all postseason, and you know at some point if you need a yard on fourth down, you're going to run that play. And then you see the Patriots run it like 6 minutes earlier. Like, imagine what you're thinking. Like, oh boy. Like, I guess they got to be expecting this one, right? But I never could have fathomed that they would run the same play and run it significantly better than the Patriots did. I thought Doug Peterson's aggressiveness on fourth down in this game might have been the difference between the Eagles winning and losing. That, you know, taking the touchdown or going for a touchdown on fourth down there instead of kicking a field goal, which nobody in the NFL, nobody covering the game, would have questioned the Eagles kicking a field goal on fourth and one with 38 seconds left in the first half, and then going for it on fourth and one on that drive, which ended up being, I believe, the game-winning drive with 9 minutes left, where they went for it on fourth and one. That, at that point, it's with 5.5 minutes left, right around midfield, and hit Zach Ertz on another mesh route to extend that drive and extend the game. Those are plays where there is a conservative way to approach it. These are plays where I think a lot of coaches, maybe the Jags last week in some situations, in the second half at least, would have punted. They would have kicked the field goal. They would have taken the points. And you can't do that against the Patriots, especially when Tom Brady's throwing for 500 yards. You have to maximize your team's chances of winning. And I have so much respect for Doug Peterson, who was willing to take the risk, was willing to assume the possibility that he would end up in infamy as a coach who made mistakes and ended up making two decisions that dramatically improved his team's chances of winning the football game.
Absolutely, and you're right. By the way, it always stinks when you walk down. And I was sort of late in terms of calling. You know, you have the process for calling what stories you're going to write among your colleagues. And and I sort of gazed over, like, what was going on. Somebody was hitting Foles. Somebody was going on Brady. The Eagles wide receivers were being mentioned. I was like, well, okay, idiots. Nobody's taking Doug Peterson. I'll take Doug Peterson. And I was like, wow, I guess. I was like, am I the only one who's, onto this as, like, the best storyline of the Super Bowl? And then it stinks when you get down and you're asking questions of these players in the press conferences. And somebody who I think is a really good football writer, and Greg Rosenthal, is, like, standing there asking the same question. Because you're like, then you see – you see a lot of other people you know what's happening, you know what's unfolding, and you see people, you know, these people that are talking to the same folks, and then the pressure is on to write better than them.
Right.
Same thing would happen if I saw you there, Bill. But it was fascinating to get these quotes from these guys specifically. The three guys that I thought were most interesting to talk to: Trey Burton, who's like, bro, it's a Super Bowl. It's Super Bowl 52. It's fourth and one. Have you ever seen anybody call that play? I watch a lot of football, and I've never seen anybody call that play. And then to hear Frank Wright talk about it, and they both said that, of course, it was called the Philly Special, and Wright said that they had it prepared to run the play against Minnesota in the NFC Championship, and the situation just never presented itself, so they sat on it. And obviously, they're thrilled that they did that. It stemmed from a play that Chicago ran previously against the Lions, maybe, and Alshon Jeffrey was on that team, and they also saw Clemson run it on a two-point conversion. So they had sort of built it in like that. The guy that really was the most interesting to hear from, his reaction about it, was owner Jeff Lurie, though, because, he's not on the sideline, he's not in the huddle, right? He's he's in the owner's box, and he's sitting there watching, and like most of us, and probably wondering what is his coach with these brass onions going to do in a situation on 4th and 1 where you could have run it with LeGarrette Blount or Jay Ajayi. Mm-hmm. I was like, were you surprised to see that? He goes, no. He's like, the play's been working great all week in practice. And he goes, Nick Foles could have caught that one-handed. And you're like, what? No, Nick Foles should not have tried to catch that one-handed. The confidence that Lurie had and that all those guys had. And you mentioned the Brady play. I agree completely. It magnifies times 100 the decision by Doug Peterson to call it after they saw the Patriots miss on the play. And who would have thought that in a game where Nick Foles and Tom Brady combined for 878 passing yards and 6 touchdowns, that the game may very well have swung on 2 pass attempts to quarterbacks. I mean, the Patriots don't convert that third down. They go on 4th and they don't get it. And then the Eagles score like 3 plays later.
Yep.
And then the Eagles on 4th and 1, if they get stopped and don't convert that play, or Foles drops the ball like Brady did, it flips the narrative, and suddenly the Patriots are getting the ball back after the Eagles fail to get points. To me, that is beyond fascinating to see how those two plays affected the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, let's say the Eagles, let's say Foles drops that pass. Suddenly it's now 15-12. Let's say the Patriots don't score on the final 34 seconds. They just, get a first down and kneel, basically. I mean, they come out the first drive of the second half, Gronk's all over the place, just runs over everyone. Easy, really a breeze of a drive ending with a Gronk touchdown catch. Suddenly it's 19-15 Patriots. The Gronk drive. And then instead of the Patriots chasing the Eagles for the entire second half, it's the Eagles chasing the Patriots for the entire second half. And who knows how that changes things, in terms of their decision making, in terms of the pass rush possibly on Nick Foles. I mean, the Eagles were able to keep the run as a viable threat all game. And the Patriots were not able to account for that. They were not able to account for the RPOs, even though, and I'm not sure if you heard this as someone who was at the game, or was in Minnesota, but, there were not as many RPOs. There were not as many RPOs as some commentators might tell you, but there were a few certainly in this game. But I mean, the Patriots were all over the place and all out of sorts in terms of defending both the run and the pass. And, the concern for me heading into this game was, well, if Brady has a really great game and the Patriots use the, no huddle to, wear out the Eagles defense and score pretty easily, which I think we could say they scored pretty effectively and threw the ball pretty effectively in this game. I would be worried about Nick Foles down 10 points or 14 points, but that never happened. They never got to that point. Number one, because the running game was effective. But number two, because Nick Foles played, if not as well as he did against Minnesota, which was the game of a lifetime in a lot of ways. I mean, he played, he went drive for drive with Tom freaking Brady in the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And belonged and played like he belonged. And it wasn't all that 4th and 1 play where you figure, okay, well, that's a trick play. You kind of fooled the Patriots. Like he was making throws, especially in the second half, making throws on the run. He was making throws in tight windows. He was hitting guys in stride. He really improved as the game went along for the second week in a row. And he belonged there. I mean, he deserved to be Super Bowl MVP. And I doubted him significantly in this game, and I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he could, after watching what Blake Bortles did and the way that the Jaguars manipulated their offense in the AFC Championship game against the Patriots defense, mm-hmm. I believe that we could see the Eagles scheme up enough things to make Nick Foles look good and to keep the Patriots from exploiting him as, a problem. But you're right, the reality is he wasn't a problem. I mean, he didn't, Brady didn't play a perfect game either. Brady looked like he was off it a little bit at times. I mean, he finished 505 yards, 3 touchdowns, no picks. I mean, sure. It's great. But he looked like his hand might have been bothering him some.
Sure.
The Eagles did get pressured, but both quarterbacks, I thought, were surprisingly effective in terms of their movement to keep plays alive. That's not what you expect to see from, Nick Foles and Tom Brady, two of the lankier, slower quarterbacks in the NFL. And both guys did an incredible job avoiding pressure. You saw it on that 4th and 1 conversion to Zach Ertz. I mean, the Patriots got after Nick Foles and they almost brought him down. They almost flipped the game at that point. And instead he was able to avoid the pressure, keep the play alive. I don't even want to say it's a poor man's Carson Wentz. He just looked, somebody tweeted this, and I don't remember who it was. I think I retweeted it, but it was Nick Foles looked like a Carson Wentz hologram. Mm-hmm. And like he did, like he was out there doing the things that Wentz does. And, you know, you got to give Foles credit for making the throws because he made a lot of tight throws. Like that Corey Clement touchdown was an absolute dime. Mm-hmm. On the same note, you got to give Doug Peterson and Frank Reich and John DeFilippo credit because they put him in a position to succeed. He made the reads right, but I mean they were using these wheel routes with the running backs out. They were using the tight ends to a large degree mm-hmm. of positive effect. And I think that run game, the fact that they were able to run with LeGarrette Blount downhill and run with Jay Ajayi really helped to take some of the pressure off. And overall, you just have to tip your cap to the Eagles offense because in a game where their defense wasn't good until the very end when it had to be, that the offense is what kept them in the game against Tom Brady.
Right. I mean, I wrote about Foles and the Eagles' chances after Wentz went out of the injury, and I said, you know, well, they still have a shot. And granted, Foles played way worse than I expected for 3 weeks, so I'm not going to try and pretend that I was like, oh, well, I think they're going to win the Super Bowl. I mean, I did not. But the argument was, okay, well, you have Nick Foles, and he's worse than Carson Wentz, but in a good scheme, that could still work out. But you have a great defense, and you have home field advantage, probably, when they were thinking about this in the postseason. So you get home field, you get that great defense, you're in good shape to make it out of the NFC. There's no great teams, and so you can parlay those two things into a meaningful opportunity. Well, he didn't have a great defense in this game. Tom Brady ripped them apart. I agree, it was not a perfect performance by any means from Brady, and they left a bunch of big plays on the field, but at the end of the day, this was a team that became the first team in the history of the National Football League to rack up 600 yards and lose. They were effective moving the football, it's fair to say. Now, they did not have home field advantage. They were playing, of course, on a neutral field. And this was a game where Nick Foles did not get the help that he had gotten in weeks past. It was not the Raiders game where he was bad, but the defense forced a bunch of takeaways. It was not the Falcons game where they scored 15 points and the defense, you know, held up on fourth and short to beat the Falcons. It was not the Vikings game where even if Nick Foles had been just okay, well, the Eagles defense was so dominant that the Vikings really were never in it after that first drive. This was a game where they needed Nick Foles to win, where they could not cover for Nick Foles. They couldn't try and win with everything else besides Nick Foles. They had to win with Nick Foles, and Nick Foles not only held up his end of the bargain, I think he exceeded everyone's expectations. I mean, he threw for 373 yards, three touchdowns, an interception, but it was on a play where, you know, it went off Alshon Jeffrey's hands.
It's not his fault. Yeah.
Right. Like, you'd never say that was a bad decision to throw that fade from Nick Foles. And like you said, so many throws that weren't just good, but were dimes. I mean, he was hitting guys in stride. And the person I thought about after the game, I have to admit, not someone who will maybe get a ton of credit this morning in Philadelphia, but Chip Kelly, a guy who had his best season with Nick, who had his best season, and Nick Foles had his best season with Chip Kelly, vice versa. And one of their best plays during that run was Mesh Wheel, which we saw the Eagles go to time after time after time in this game against the Patriots. We saw that on the 50-plus yard throw to Corey Clement. We saw it on the, I believe, the fourth and one where he hit Hurts to extend the game. I mean, it was a concept they went back to repeatedly. The Patriots struggled to look at it all game. They struggled with it over the past few weeks as well, both on the Patriots side and on the Eagles offensive side. And I realized that Chip Kelly was not perfect. He would not be someone I would pick as general manager. The game, in some ways, I perhaps may have passed him by, but his influence is still felt on this team. And I certainly think that Doug Peterson will be tipping his cap to Chip Kelly for what he did in terms of developing Nick Foles.
Isn't it cool how you can't, and you know, it's just not how it works in the NFL. Like the guy who won the Super Bowl, Doug Peterson, is going to get the credit, but you can't write this Eagles Super Bowl story without including Chip Kelly and Andy Reid, right? Yeah. Their fingerprints are all over this success. Even if you want to point out that, well, Chip Kelly had one mesh wheel. Well, no, Chip Kelly, there were lots of Chip Kelly draft picks involved in that. You know, Nelson Aguilar, very nice game, very nice season. Surprised everybody with the way that he played this year. Mm-hmm. Nick Foles, of course, developed, had his best season as a pro under Chip Kelly, but drafted by Andy Reid in the third round when they couldn't get Russell Wilson, allegedly. And just so many players that came from the Reid era, that came from the Kelly era, and then the one thing that links them all together, really, there was Howie Roseman. And I think when we look back at this Eagles team, and I believe they'll have a sustained, you know, success run of success here, Bill, because they have Carson Wentz. You know, they have talent on the defensive line, talent on the offensive line, and salary cap issues will have to work out. But by and large, I mean, this is a team that is loaded in terms of talent, and Howie Roseman deserves a ton of credit because not only do they have a lot of good players, but they are deep at many positions. I mean, you know, we criticize the, you know, oh, you got Nick Foles, you can't win a Super Bowl with Nick Foles. Well, they did. And the fact that they had Nick Foles is a big credit to them because this is a team that is invested in quarterback, in the quarterback depth chart. It is invested in pass rushers and is invested in running backs when it looked like that. I remember we talked about the Eagles before the season and we pointed out that the running backs at the time, it was what, Wendell Smallwood, they had signed LeGarrette Blount and Darren Sproles. We're like, how is this going to work? And then all of a sudden it's a strength by the end of the year. I mean, Howie Roseman deserves a ton of credit for his personnel moves with the Eagles.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you look at some of the guys on this roster and you benefited from teams that had salary cap issues that were maybe perhaps too aggressive in making mistakes. And the Eagles, in a lot of cases, ended up getting more than I think you would have expected from those guys. Alshon Jeffrey was a guy who the Bears didn't want to franchise, didn't think they could convince him to stick around, didn't want to give him $17 million this offseason, and he comes to Philadelphia initially on a one-year deal, impresses, gets a long-term deal, and he was a monster last week, and then early this week in the early in the Super Bowl before they kind of put Stephon Gilmore in him and sort of, you know, went to other parts of that defense. Now, at running back, LeGarrette Blount was a guy who was in free agency for a while, signed a one-year deal, was out of the rotation as recently as last week. He barely played, but huge role in this game. Jay Ajayi, someone who the Dolphins decided was the problem with their team for some reason, doesn't appear to have fixed the Dolphins' problems. Eagles are quite happy to have him around. Timmy Jernigan, another guy who the Ravens, you know, didn't have the cap space to sign, and Philadelphia said, oh, we'll take that guy. We'll figure out if we can re-sign him later. They're going to. And a team that's just, this is a team built around the offensive line and the defensive line. And that's a tale as old as football. It's not modern, but it's effective. And that offensive line, even without Jason Peters, dominated. I thought Hal Vitae had an awesome game across, mostly from Trey Flowers. The offensive line really beat up the Patriots. There was no real answer Bill Belichick had for handling Jason Kelce and that Eagles offensive line and that Eagles running game. And then the defensive line, well, didn't do a ton. They were struggling a bit with the no huddle, but when they needed a play, guess who showed up? Brandon Graham, who's been around forever on the Eagles defensive line, moved to the inside, beat, I believe, Shaq Mason, and came up with a sack in a situation where, I don't know, Will, I mean, in that spot, let me ask you this. Now, the situation was the Eagles were up five. It was second and two from the Patriots' 33-yard line with 2:16 left. The Patriots had a timeout and the 2-minute warning. I mean, do you think, if you had to pick a winner from that spot, would you pick the Eagles up by 5 points in that moment before the fumble?
I think at that point in time, I saw somebody tweet this out. That's the only reason I know this. But I believe when the Eagles were up by five, in fact, I think actually, well, somebody decided to take down a TV in the media room, Bill. Sorry. Podcast. Can you hear the drill? If you can, I will move.
No.
The Eagles, when they were down one, before they even got up five, were actually on the money line, I believe, -210, because the belief was that the Eagles would figure out a way to melt the clock and then kick a field goal and come away with the win. But when the Eagles were up five, and even when the Eagles were up eight, in both instances, I was pretty much under the impression that Tom Brady would get the ball back and that Tom Brady would go down the field and Tom Brady would score some kind of touchdown and Tom Brady would take the game to overtime because that's what Tom Brady does. So if you'd been asking me to pick a winner, I probably would have gone with the Patriots, if only because we've seen this play too many. That was the line that popped into my head when Brady got the ball. It's like, we've seen this play. Tom Brady has been unstoppable all day long. The Eagles can't get home with their pass rush. You know, they can't settle for a field goal, but they have Gronk, who's been lighting it up in the second half. Mm-hmm. They have Brady, who's been finding these guys who have been running wide open. Yes, I will take the Patriots to win in that situation most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, you look at their previous drives, it had been 10-play 75-yard touchdown drive. Right before that was a 7-play 75-yard touchdown drive. Right before that, Maggie's not barking at that person who's taking down the television in the media room.
Well, the worst thing is that the guy who's taking down the television, I asked him, I came in and I was like, hey, I have to do a podcast. Is it cool if I do it in here? He's like, oh, yeah, I don't think it'll be a problem. he pulled out a drill. why you could have told me you were going to be using a drill.
It just adds ambiance. The
three drives were like, it was like 25 plays, 220 yards and three touchdowns in the span of like 19 minutes. It felt like the Patriots were controlling the second half.
Yeah, I mean, this was you would not have expected the Eagles to come up with a stop, but, and I mentioned this in my column, it was almost like things flipped. Like, the Patriots are the team where, we just expect them to come up with a play when they need it because they're the Patriots, and we've seen the Dante Hightower strip sack last year. We saw the Malcolm Butler interception. We'll get to him in a moment after the break. We saw the Daron Harmon, I believe, interception against the Steelers after the Jesse James play earlier this year. I mean, they come up with a turnover in the exact moment when they need it. And in this game, that was the Eagles. That wasn't the Patriots. It was the strip sack from Brandon Graham. So, I mean, it was such a critical moment. And it was honestly... I don't want to say I thought the Eagles were definitely going to win at that point because, you know, anything can happen. You can fumble a snap. You can make a mistake. The Patriots could still pull something out, of course, they're the Patriots. But it really did sort of set in like, oh, wow, this is probably going to happen now. And, it wasn't a great performance from the defensive line, but it was a great moment when they needed one. And that's what you do. It's what you can do when you have 5, 6, 7 guys who can roll out in a defensive rotation. Even if the Patriots do go no huddle, you can still get a guy on the field for a big play when you absolutely need one.
What did you think about the Eagles' final possession where they got the Jake Elliott field goal? Because I was really surprised that Doug Peterson didn't throw on second or third down. And I understand what you're thinking. Not you, but Doug Peterson is thinking in terms of, look, I mean, we can melt the clock and get this thing down there, but you knew it was only going to get down to about a minute.
Yep.
You knew that even if you didn't get the first down and you ran the ball twice, that you were going to be facing a mid 40-yard field goal, and it ended up being 46 yards, and Jake Elliott drilled it, but it was a game where there was tons of kicking issues, multiple extra points missed. Goskowski, who's, you know, doinks one after a bot snap. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised that Doug Peterson didn't throw on second or third down, but maybe he was playing assuming that the Patriots would think he would throw.
So many psychologies built in here. I really think the time to throw would have been on second down for a lot of reasons.
Yes.
Of course, you know, you're less likely perhaps to expect a throw on second down than you would be on third down, where it's, you know, you're trying to get that one first down to win the game and you're a little more desperate. I think the timing of the 2-minute warning probably came into play, where it was 2:03 left and the clock was going to stop after that play almost regardless. You know, maybe if you get a smoke screen that Nick Foles one hops and it only takes 2 seconds off the clock, maybe that's possible, but I'm skeptical of that. It's, you know, even if you throw an incompletion, it's going to be a 2-minute warning. Whether you complete the pass, go out of bounds, no matter what you do, the clock is going to stop after the play. So that's kind of giving you an opportunity to throw the ball without the risk that there is on third down of losing the opportunity to run clock. So I think a play action pass would have been a very plausible decision on second down. I wouldn't have faulted them for that. On third down, I can't fault them for running the ball. I know that it's, you want to try and get a first down. You want to try and get a shorter field goal. But, I mean, I don't know. I can't sit here and say I want to give the ball back to Tom Brady, with the possibility of a minute 50 down 5. I think you're sort of balancing the worst case scenario with, the different range of possibilities. And I think you have the opportunity to at least get the clock down no matter what. Even if you miss the field goal, I think that would have been, the big thing there.
Yeah, and that was not me. It was just
that's fair. Do you
that was just a fellow media member with a stool that fell over. That wasn't even the TV.
Wow, it's a dangerous space.
Okay,
it's
actually cozy and there are lots of plants in here. It's very surprising.
That's nice. Do you were you against the Peterson decisions to go for two earlier in the game?
Yeah, I was, primarily because I didn't understand why he did it. I mean, I understand you're chasing the points, but, you know, it just felt like, look, you missed an extra point, and you know, you don't have to go for two just to get that extra point back. Like, this is a game where clearly there are going to be some points scored. I think that was evident from the get-go, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, when it, in that first quarter, it was kind of clear that this was going to be a shootout and not going to be the defensive affair that, that some of us predicted. And so when you realize that, to me, just get the points when you can get the points. And it became clear, I thought, that he would have liked to have those points back when they were down one. Mm-hmm. And then again when they were up eight, because they would have been up nine and not worried about the Hail Mary. Right. Now, granted, the extra point plays out differently and maybe changes the game and how you approach things. But I was surprised by that, although it does fit with the narrative of being aggressive. And I have to assume that someone was in Doug Peterson's ear from an analytics standpoint. Like, mm-hmm. That's how they've done it all year. So I would assume somebody gave him the green light for that. I was on a text thread with some friends. We had some interest in various props and whatnot, and just texting about the game in general during the course of the game. And I was questioning the extra point and the 2-point conversion attempt. And they were like, don't be ridiculous. He got it all back by going for it on those two fourth downs. Like, it washes out. But I did not agree with the decision on the 2-point conversion at the time.
Interesting. I mean, I'm okay with it. I think having a 14-point lead is awful nice there. I mean, I don't think it's an enormous difference either way. Obviously, if you make it, it's a pretty big difference, but I think the possibility of making it and getting up by two touchdowns in full, there's definitely some value to that. So I think that early in the game, there's not going to be an enormous difference in terms of win probability. I do feel a little bad for Patriots punter Ryan Allen, who maybe he went into this game thinking, okay, you know, I'm going to get a few booming punts off. I'm going to have a big game. Invited all my family to come watch me in the Super Bowl again, and then he doesn't punt once all game, and his most notable play is that he actually fumbles what looked to be an okay snap and cost the Patriots 3 points early on.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is that when you look at the way that the special teams went for both teams, it didn't go well, obviously. Mm-hmm. Stephen Gostkowski missed one field goal and missed two extra points. I got to give credit to my colleague John Breach, who is at CBS Sports, who is a bit of a kicking aficionado because of his dad's Jim Breach, who kicked for the Bengals and came close to winning a couple Super Bowls. But John pointed out in the pregame that Stephen Gostkowski was not on his game. I mean, he missed twice from once on each side of the field from right around 50 yards, and you sort of wonder if that doesn't get in your head a little bit if you're Gostkowski. And whether or not it affected, you know, I mean, like I don't know, I don't think it affected Allen on the hold, but I mean, certainly, it didn't feel like the vibe was there for the kicking game in New England before the game started. John pointed that out, and then it turned out to be a major factor in the game when it actually started.
Oh yeah, I mean, this was a game where you'd figure, looking at the numbers, the Patriots would have had an advantage on special teams, and it did not happen. I wouldn't say the Eagles' special teams were phenomenal, but you mentioned those misses for the Patriots. You mentioned, or I'm going to mention the weird play on the final kickoff return to try and get a reverse going, which I understand you want to try and something a little more aggressive down 8 points to try and create a big play, but it did not work and it locked the Patriots.
That was a terrible call. Why did they do that? That was you give up 10 yards, like 5 to 10 yards, and 5 to 10 seconds. That you could have given to Tom Brady instead of a return. I get the upside in it, but the downside is you fumble, you lose the game. And I would have rather had the yardage for Brady on a Hail Mary attempt, personally.
Yeah, me too. I would have rather probably just let the ball, or try to get the ball into the end zone for a touchback and see what I can do with giving Tom Brady as much time as possible. But I don't think Ryan Allen had the worst day of any Patriot in the lineup, and we'll get to the player who I would say is leaving the Super Bowl with the most frustrated state of mind after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. But first, guys, you don't want to look like a fool on Valentine's Day. You don't want to be some dum-dum who forgets to get a gift and gets something at the last second and makes a dumb mistake, disappoints their partner who has been sitting with them watching football all year, perhaps helped them out during the Super Bowl, made some food, didn't complain when you were yelling and screaming about how your missed extra points prop bet came through or didn't come through if you were listening to me on Behind the Bets. The point is, you can really help make your partner's Valentine's Day something special. And you should do that by preparing in advance and getting a gift that is 3 times softer than cotton. Wouldn't you want to give the person you love or care for the softest materials on earth? Just seems like something you should do. And the good news is you can do it with his partner of the Bill Barnwell Show, MeUndies. Because MeUndies, you know, they're the most comfortable and fun undies you and your significant other will ever own. And this Valentine's Day, you can get your partner a gift that's for the both of you, not just a selfish gift for you, but a gift for both of you. That seems better than getting your partner a gift, to be honest, if you're being selfish. And if you're not being selfish, it seems altruistic to get them a gift they're going to love. So if you order by February 5th at 10 a.m., you'll get free standard shipping and your gift will arrive in time for Valentine's Day. And you can get matching pairs. So not only will your partner have fun, comfortable underwear, you will too. And that seems like a win-win. It just seems like it's an obvious move for you to make. And of course, with MeUndies, there is a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If your partner doesn't like it, if you don't like it, again, I've never met anyone who tried MeUndies and did not like it, myself included. But let's say it doesn't work out for you, return it for free, no questions asked. MeUndies will give you your money back and your partner's money back. But you're not going to have to worry about that because you're going to get underwear you're going to love, and you're going to get it for 20% off with free shipping by using my promo code. To get that, go to MeUndies.com/Barnwell. You'll get 20% off your matching pairs, free shipping by Valentine's Day if you order by February 5th, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Again, MeUndies.com/Barnwell, 20% off, free shipping, a 100% satisfaction guarantee delivered by Valentine's Day, MeUndies.com/Barnwell. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Still joining me is CBS's Will Brinson. And, Will, you almost played as many snaps in the Super Bowl as Malcolm Butler. It was 1-0 on Sunday. And I have to admit, if there had been a prop bet for Will Brinson snaps versus Malcolm Butler snaps, -1.5, I probably would have taken Malcolm Butler before the game. So it would have been a loss for me. It ended up being a very frustrating loss for Malcolm Butler.
I would have bet my family lives.
Oh, no.
And my house on that. If Malcolm Butler -1.5, what don't I know? I mean, it would have gone south for everybody involved. But, you know, I was aware that I wasn't going to play any snaps 10 minutes before the game, or that I was going to, you know, play 0 snaps. I knew how many snaps I was going to play 10 minutes before the game. Apparently, Malcolm Butler did not. And, you know, this is a guy who was the hero of Super Bowl 49, made the interception, came out of nowhere, literally, to make the interception of Russell Wilson to save the Patriots from another potential Super Bowl loss. And he was subject to much off-season speculation about where he would end up. Sure. He thought he was going to go to New Orleans for a little while. Ended up staying in New England. They signed Stephon Gilmore. Butler, during the week, said he had an S-H-I-T-T-Y year. This is quote. I think I can spell it on your podcast, Bill. Family. The S word, as we say in our house. Okay. And then he's benched. And it's crazy because the Eagles were throwing all over the place. And it seems like Malcolm Butler would have been a good player to have if the Eagles were throwing all over the place. There is tons of speculation about why he was absent. And the Patriots are not indulging in any discussion of it.
That something does not add up in this discussion.
No.
That there is, you can make one argument and you're like, okay, well, maybe this would make sense. But then there's an argument that crushes that argument. You could say, okay, well, you know, maybe he wasn't 100% and the Patriots didn't want to risk him. Well, that's fine. But then you don't activate him. You don't play him on special teams. He hasn't played a special team snap in 2 years. He took one special team snap on Sunday, so he had no spot on the roster. Now, why would you activate him if you're not going to play him? Well, you figure maybe the Patriots did actually think Malcolm Butler, who struggled, it's fair to say, during the season, maybe he was a bad matchup against the Eagles. Maybe if he was weakened by illness, you would want to put in Eric Rowe. You'd want to put in Johnson Badamosi for some snaps against the Eagles defense and not have to rely on Malcolm Butler. But those guys had a terrible game. Eric Rowe got beat early for a touchdown. Johnson Badamosi was a mess in the slot. He's a special teamer. He does not belong there. They didn't give Malcolm Butler even a single defensive snap. And that is unconscionable when it comes to the Patriots. It's not It's not even that they benched him, because that maybe that made sense. But to bench him and not even give him a single snap when your defense is being ripped apart by Nick Foles? You can't sit there after the game and pretend that that was just a football decision. That just doesn't add up. It just does not fit any explanation for a Belichick move over the last 17 years. There's not been a game where he made this curious of a decision and there were this many questions you can make about it after the game. And even if the Patriots had won, even if Tom Brady had not been strip sacked by Brandon Graham and they'd gone on a score touchdown and win that drive, it would be a bizarre and curious choice from Bill Belichick. And there has to be something else, right? Like, there has to be some argument for something happened off the field or something happened that was a disciplinary issue, because it can't just be that Bill Belichick suddenly decided Malcolm Butler was not even worth any defensive snaps in the biggest game of the year.
It's mind-boggling. There are sort of rumors and speculation percolating around Minnesota that maybe is it factual that he missed the flight? Do we know that he missed the flight because he was allegedly ill? Maybe some chatter about a missed curfew. I don't want to assign that to who I think said it, unless in case they haven't said it actually publicly. But it just sounds like there were issues surrounding Butler. And even then, Bill, how did this not become one of those things where it's like in college when a college player does something bad and he gets benched for the first quarter? You know, like, how was it? Is that we're suspending him for the first quarter? It's like, really stepping up your game. Bill Belichick suspended him for the whole game, and they were getting carved up by Nick Foles. I don't understand it. It has to have been not something that was personal, but an issue where Bill Belichick decided he was not putting Malcolm Butler above the team, and yet he sort of did by not playing him.
Okay, so I mean, if let's say he missed a flight, which is totally plausible, he was sick during the week, so maybe that helped him, maybe that helped cause him to miss a flight, who knows, but he missed a flight earlier in his career. Belichick sat him for about 3 weeks. Belichick has a history of not taking it very fondly when players do not show up on time. Sure, okay, that's fine. Maybe you want to discipline Malcolm Butler. Like you said, discipline him for a quarter, discipline him for a half. That's the more plausible thing to do. Let's say you're really pissed if you're Bill Belichick. Then don't play him. I mean, if you're not going to play him, don't activate him. Activate Kenny Britt. Yeah. Activate Alan Branch. Activate someone else who you're not upset with. I don't understand why you, even if you want to not play him all game, why he is on your active roster. The only reason I could think he would be on the active roster would be if the Patriots if someone got hurt and they had to play Malcolm Butler and had no choice. And if that's the case, nobody got hurt, but they were playing badly enough that I was concerned that Johnson Bademosi or Eric Rowe had the flu. I mean, they were getting torched drive after drive after drive. That would have been enough to say, okay, maybe we can be angry at Malcolm after the game. Just give it a shot. And, you saw it on the opening, you know, during the national anthem when Malcolm Butler was crying. I mean, it wasn't like this was a thing where he didn't know what was happening. He was being left on the sideline to rot. And there's no argument I can think of that justifies what happened with Malcolm Butler in this game, given the activation, given the not playing, that combo does not add up. So, maybe we'll never get an answer. I don't know.
The other thing that doesn't add up either is that clearly the Eagles wouldn't have seen it coming. They're like, what? Malcolm Butler's not playing? That's weird. We didn't, you know, weren't expecting that. That's throwing us off a little bit, but not in a bad way. But also that Belichick would tell Eric Rowe that he's starting 10 minutes before the game or tell, you know, I mean, he basically informed these guys that this was all going down right before the game based on what the player said afterwards. And that is decidedly un-Belichickian, right? I mean, he allowed drama to creep into the Super Bowl week with one of his players on the defensive side of the ball. And it then took over the team's overall ability to execute because it was a problem in the minutes leading up to the Super Bowl. I mean, that is the opposite of do your job. And I don't get it either. I don't get how he could make the decision. It felt sort of like this whole franchise tag rumor with Kirk Cousins. Mm-hmm. You're making a bad decision. You're just doing it because you're mad.
Yeah. And I mean, if the Patriots had a great defense, if they had a dominant front seven, you'd say, okay, well, we can bench Malcolm Butler because it's not going to come down to one cornerback. And maybe it wouldn't have come down to Malcolm Butler. He'd struggled all year. Maybe he would have been bad in this game too. I don't necessarily think that he solves your problems, but this is a Patriots defense that was 31st in DVOA. They were a bad defense this year, and we saw it happened even in the Jags game. Blake Bortles had a ton of success against them, and until the Jaguars really gave up and got very conservative with their play calling in the second half. And I mean, they were not a good matchup for the Eagles, and they did not get any pressure on him, and they didn't have the horses to leave one of their better starters on the bench. I mean, this is a team that Johnson Bademosi is a special teams guy. He should not be playing regular snaps for you at slot corner. In the front seven, James Harrison, who couldn't get on the field for the Steelers, was cast off by them. He played 68 to 75 snaps in this game. He played over 90% of the defensive snaps, and he had a play here or there, but it's not like he should be an every down outside linebacker at his age for your football team. You had Landon Roberts playing more than 55% of the snaps. You had Jordan Richards, who again is a safety who's not much more than a special teamer, who was on the field and got beat more than once. Eric Lee, who was a cast off, I believe, from the Bills practice squad, who had never played an NFL game and was a starter 2 weeks later for the Patriots. I mean, these are guys who they should not be playing meaningful roles in your defense. And for all the credit we give Bill Belichick for his ability to coach those guys up and get them into meaningful roles, and I'm sure he got the most out of them in their situations, they weren't enough. They weren't enough against an Eagles team that has a great offensive line and had receivers playing great football and a quarterback who was picking them apart for most of the game without much pass pressure.
Yeah, and like, what's the downside of Butler playing? He blows some coverage and the Eagles score 41 points? I mean, I don't understand it. Like, he gives up a touchdown pass to a receiver. They gave up lots of touchdown passes. They gave up four of them. One of them to Nick Foles. It just feels like the upside that Butler would have presented, given what we've seen from him on a stage like this, should have outweighed whatever issues they had from a personnel standpoint or a personal standpoint or whatever it was. I mean, I respect Belichick for sticking by his guns, and you know, this decision is not going to change the fact that I think he's the best, you know, coach in the history of the NFL. But it is a bizarre move on the biggest stage from a guy who's been there so many times.
Mm-hmm. And this is the end of Butler's career with the Patriots. You'd figure. I can't imagine he's going to come back as a free agent after this. So, I mean, I just think if you're Bill Belichick, you're going to have to sit there. He has plenty of Super Bowl rings. He's not lacking for success, but I can't imagine he's going to sit there over this offseason and in the years to come with maybe what was his last chance with this core of players and say, you know what? We did the right thing. We put our best players on the field. I did my job because Malcolm Butler just, it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't have been a better defense with him on the field. And I bring up the last chance with this core thing, not because there's not going to be a ton of talent here, not because I believe that Tom Brady is retiring, but one guy who might be leaving, and I don't know if this is the case, is Rob Gronkowski, who after the game was asked about his future and said he was going to take some time to think about it, which is a phrase I've never heard Rob Gronkowski say about literally any topic before. So it does seem a little surprising that he would be that conservative at his future. It doesn't mean that he's going to retire, but there's at least a possibility that we could have seen the last of a player who was dominant for long stretches of this game.
I was stunned to hear that. It's like, hey, Gronk, you're not Big Ben. You're not supposed to be doing this drama thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like your job is to make the Yo Soy Fiesta jokes after the Super Bowl.
To tell us not to eat Tide Pods.
So yeah, eat Tide Pods. Yeah, tell people not to eat Tide Pods. You know, he's only 28. He has won a lot of football games. Is it possible that Rob Gronkowski, if he left the game right now, would be the greatest tight end of all time? Yes, it's Yes, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the closest comp I can come up with, and it's going to be sacrilege to some, you might say, is Jim Brown. I mean, this is a guy who he's that much better, I think, than the tight ends of the past. And maybe Jim Brown's a little bit of hyperbole, but in terms of his career path, his career length, in terms of how productive he was and how dominant he was versus other players at his position, I mean, there's not many guys out there who compare to Gronk. I mean, this is a guy who you would say probably the best receiving tight end in football, certainly the biggest red zone threat in football of the last 7 years, and a guy who's a top five blocker on top of that, who no one even thinks about his blocking ability. I mean, the health is a concern. He hasn't been healthy, of course, but on the field, snap for snap, I mean, there's not a more dominant player in football to me than outside of maybe J.J. Watt at his peak, who's not a quarterback, than Rob Gronkowski. So, I mean, there's no replacing Gronk. Even if you have Brandon Cooks and Julian Edelman back and you bring back Danny Amendola, and maybe you sign Tyler Eifert or somebody, I mean, Gronk is Gronk. He's the core of what this offense does, and you have to fundamentally change if you don't have him around next year.
If they were to lose Gronk, and, you know, Brandon Cooks coming back and Edelman coming back from an ACL, and they're just not the same. I mean, they're just not. I mean, I'm sure that Cooks would be good, but Cooks is not the perfect number one weapon for Tom Brady. You know, right. He's a very good receiver. And does a lot of things nice, but I don't think he's the ideal number one weapon for Brady. And Edelman is fantastic, but without Gronk, you're right. It takes away the seams. It takes away the red zone threat. And by the way, Mike Florio tweeted before the game at 3:30 p.m. This is 99% wild guess, but it would not shock me at all if Gronk retires after tonight's game. So like, so I'm not sure. I mean, he's saying it's a wild guess, but then Gronk said he might think about leaving. I can sort of see where I could sort of see why Gronk might do it from the perspective of he has, and I'm just trying to come up with the logic behind it, but he has made a ton of money. He has battled a lot of physical injuries, you know, dating back to his back issues in college. It cannot be easy being that tall and taking the abuse he takes. He has secured his legacy, and it seems like he has lots of other interests. Maybe wrestling, and those interests don't necessarily collide with the Patriot way. He could see a situation with Josh McDaniels probably leaving and Tom Brady gone soon where he doesn't, and Bill Belichick probably gone soon where he doesn't want to just lock into a, you know, 5-year deal or something like that. So maybe, I mean, maybe he really does walk away. If he does and the Patriots lose both coordinators, I don't think the Patriots, even as good as Tom Brady is, should necessarily be the favorites to win the Super Bowl next year.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you'll certainly see. I mean, he's a guy who played every single snap. The only other player outside of the offensive line who played every single snap for the Patriots yesterday was Brady. He is a guy who we've known his entire career that it's probably going to be a short one because of his back, which cost him his final year at Arizona. And we also just have an idea that even if it's not this offseason for Gronk, even if he says, okay, I'm going to come back, you know, this isn't going to be a long thing. It's not going to be 6 or 7 more years with Gronk. It might be 1 more year. It might be 2 more years. But this is a team that's going to be transitioning in the near future, and Gronk is going to be part of that transition because he's probably not going to be on the field. Let me finish up with this, Will. On the other side of the field, there's Nick Foles, who just won Super Bowl MVP. And is probably, I mean, there's not a quarterback controversy. Carson Wentz is going to be the starter in Philadelphia if he's healthy next year. So what do you do with Nick Foles, who has 1 year left on his contract? I mean, if you're Howie Roseman, who's as aggressive as trading veterans as anybody in football, do you at least listen to trade offers for your suddenly valuable backup quarterback?
Yeah, you absolutely, this is a fascinating, yes. Okay, to answer your question, yes, you totally listen to trade offers. I was having this argument with Prisco and Costas earlier, and I'm curious your thoughts on it, Bill, because if you're Nick Foles, and 2 years ago you were hating your life with the Rams, you got traded there in a swap for Sam Bradford, you signed an extension, you were under the impression you're the guy and you're going to play and start, and then you get benched for Case Keenum, and you think about retiring. You go and spend a year backing up Alex Smith. You play one, I think you start one game, and then you come and you win the Super Bowl in Philly, and you're happy with the team that drafted you. You love the organization. You love the coaches. Mm-hmm. Does Nick Foles definitely want to leave? Because I think he wants to go play somewhere. But would he rather start in Cleveland or sit or be the backup to Carson Wentz in Philadelphia next year? I think that's a fair question, right?
Yeah, I mean, he is a guy who, at the same time, though, he lived through Jeff Fisher. I mean, he is a guy who knows this is the grass isn't always greener on the other side, even
right.
if there's a bigger opportunity. So I would not fault him for wanting to move on and getting a bigger role. I think he will eventually start somewhere else in this league. But I also wouldn't fault him for saying, hey, I'm in a city where no one is ever going to force me to pay for a drink again. I'm going to be the most popular backup quarterback in the history of the National Football League, outside of maybe Nathan Peterman. And I'm going to have next year where Carson Wentz may not be 100%. I'm going to be ready to go week one. And if I if I don't play all year, well, I'm going to hit free agency as the Super Bowl MVP, and someone's going to pay me to be a starter. So I wouldn't. You know, I can't fault him for any decision he makes. I think he can justify any choice with Nick Foles. But from Howie Roseman's side, let's finish up with this. What would it take in terms of a trade offer to get you to trade away Nick Foles, given that you have a quarterback who's coming off of a knee injury?
I would need a pretty nice return.
Like what?
I think I would probably do it for the original Alex Smith 49ers Chiefs package. So if somebody gave me 2 second round picks, mm-hmm. I'd probably do it. I would certainly consider it for a second round pick, but I don't think I'd do it for anything less than that. And certainly if somebody's willing to give you a first round pick, that's a no brainer. I wouldn't anticipate that that's the case. And it would probably have to be a first round pick in this year's draft, but next year would be fine too. Any round, 2020 is actually cool too. I just don't think that the Eagles, the way that they're constructed, and from what we've seen from Howie Roseman in terms of building depth at the quarterback position, remember, he went out and got Carson Wentz, and he got mm-hmm. Sam Bradford, and he got Chase Daniels all in the same year, and he dealt Bradford for a first-round pick. But you also don't want to trade Nick Foles and then have Carson Wentz suffer some kind of setback from an ACL yep. injury in the preseason, I hate saying this because you don't even want to think about it being true, but what if he hurts himself again?
Right.
You know, what if 6 months from now we're like, well, Carson Wentz might be injury prone. I mean, he has a style of playing football that is not conducive to staying healthy because he is aggressive with his body in terms of running the ball and taking hits. So if I'm Howie Roseman and I know that I have a Super Bowl core intact, and you factually you do because you just won one with the team and you're going to have most of these guys back, I'm not trading Nick Foles unless I'm getting a really nice return, because you know that Nick Foles can lead you to a Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Bills and Jets, two teams with 2 second-round picks, could theoretically at least make an offer for Nick Foles, but I think a lot to be done for the Eagles, Patriots. Off-season to come. We are there. Season is over. Will Brinson, you've been one of the best guests we've had on all year. Definitely someone I wanted to have on for the season finale show, like you mentioned, but thank you so much. Please plug your various internet properties.
People can check out writing at cbssports.com. I'm sure that you can figure there's somewhere you can figure out where I wrote stuff on that website. Twitter at Will Brinson. And then we do the Pick Six podcast, which people can listen to. We have a Super Bowl recap up right now where I'm accused of talking too much, which I probably did on your podcast too, Bill. But I enjoy talking to you, so I don't mind doing it.
That is why you're on the show. You're supposed to talk. I can't carry right. the load here. That's what you're for.
Right. But I don't understand. They're like, what are you? You're really talkative today. What's going on? We're literally creating a product that is us talking. What do you, the day after the Super Bowl, what are you guys getting mad at me for talking?
It was a great game. You should be talkative about that game. If that didn't do it for you, if you're like, yeah, I'm bored, then this isn't the sport for you. You should be going to cover something else. Well, Brinson, you can talk as much as you want on the Bill Barnwell show. That is my guarantee.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure, buddy.
Actually, no, you can't talk anywhere now because we're going to wrap up the show. But next time, all you want. I promise. All right, guys, thanks so much for listening to the Blue Barn Roll Show all season, and certainly this final episode of the 2017 year with Will Brinson. We're going to come back tomorrow. We're going to talk about some of the preseason props we hit before the year, but we're in off-season mode right now. So you're going to see some football. Of course, as football news breaks, we're going to do some other sports stuff. I don't think any Bachelor this year, but certainly some basketball, baseball, some soccer, maybe even some hockey. I don't know. The possibilities are out there. But we're going to be moving on to a mix of things during the offseason. So definitely keep on listening. Subscribe, give us reviews, all that good stuff. You know what to do. But certainly thanks for listening to all the NFL coverage this year. And we'll have more of it during the offseason. But thanks so much. And more Bill Barnwell Show to come.